You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the Midside, where claims of racism on a college campus in upstate New York are always ignored. I'm your host, Justin M. Lesneski, and let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. William is trying to get us to talk about the Syracuse news that's going on, Syracuse University, where people falsely claim there was racism. Look, I went to school in upstate New York, on a campus in upstate New York. That's all they do all day is claim that people are being racist against each other. That is their hobby, because there is nothing else to do, especially now that Syracuse is shitty at all sports. All right, so this is the biggest non-story of non-stories ever. Also joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
No atheist in the country is praying harder than myself right now for Ruth Bader Ginsburg's speedy recovery. She is in the hospital yet again for what has been described as chills. Not kidding. And she'll be released hopefully today, but no word on that. I pray to Zeus and all other fake gods that she is well and ready to go on Monday morning for the court, because I don't want to live in a world where Donald Trump gets to pick her replacement right now.
Why is that? Why you said the word right now? Because you liked Brett Kavanaugh, correct?
I like him as a person.
Wow.
What's with the pause there?
Look, the cry about Trump in the court is, but Gorsuch. Because Neil Gorsuch has been the greatest Supreme Court justice of my life, maybe of the modern era. Kavanaugh, he's a little more like Roberts. You win some, you lose some. But he's a nice guy. No, I don't want to live in that world because I literally live in that world. And that world would probably be set on fire, quite literal fire, if Donald Trump gets to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg's, or gets to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the court in an election year. Are you kidding me? Didn't we just have this fight?
Can we find someone with multiple vaginas to make up for it? Because you know it would have to be a woman, right? Or maybe Blair White. We could nominate Blair White, a trans person that's conservative. I'm sure that would go over fine.
Yeah,
I'm
but
sure it would.
The last name is White.
Oh, it's rough. She's going to have to change it to something else.
But I am convinced the only way to get out of all of this is to have this speed down the track towards peak farce as quickly as possible. So having Donald Trump replace a Supreme Court nominee during an election year would
not
make this the greatest train wreck in the history of train wrecks.
Let me be very clear. If for whatever reason, like, Kagan stepped out or something, I don't know why she would, but if she did, it'd be big, but it would be nothing compared to him replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Let's be very clear about that. She is like the messiah of the left.
All right. Well, do not adjust the RBG on your monitors because this is an audio show. Also joining us from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forego his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, we just couldn't squeeze the Syracuse story in today, huh? I mean, a bunch of students of...
We couldn't squeeze the orange?
A bunch of students of color shrieking at their administration about how terrible their school is. Can't they go to another school?
Nope.
Is it,
nope.
Look,
is it a plantation?
Is what...
Are they being held against their will? Do we need to send in the National Guard?
Oh my God, I'm having flashbacks to undergrad. Flashbacks to undergrad, all right? Look, this is literally what they do, okay? Look, I hate this because, like, I don't want to get collectivist and I don't want to, like, generalize. because
but you will psychologicalize.
No, there are individuals who are very nice. So I'm talking generally here. Look, when I was at Ithaca, in the campus center, there were two TV rooms. One TV room, that's where all the black people hung out. They self-segregated. I am not making this up. They self-segregated. And then there was this trend. It was like, you know, Ithaca has all these beautiful gorges there, you know, where the Cornell kids jump to commit suicide.
Oh, my God.
And people would wear these shirts. Ithaca is gorgeous, right? Oh, my God, it's a pond, huh? It's so clever. So then people would start doing variations on it where they're like, oh, man, the girls would wear shirts. They were like, Katie is gorgeous. And I'm like, are you saying you're gorgeous or are you unintentionally calling yourself very loose? It didn't make any sense, right? Then there were some black women who thought they were very, very clever, and they got black shirts. So the normal ones were green, right? The Ithaca is gorgeous were green because, haha, environmentalism, green. And then, you know, the when girls called themselves unintentionally loose, they would, like, wear pink and purple and things like that. Then a few black women got really smart, and they decided, hey, we're going to get a black shirt and put on it, Ithaca is racist. And they walked around all day wearing those shirts. And then went to their self-segregated television room in the campus center.
Why? Ithaca? What? Ithaca's like the leftiest left of the left of the leftiest left. If they're racist, the rest of the country is Klan-wearing, horse-riding grand wizards.
Well, see, I didn't want to talk about this. I guess.
You didn't?
Wait, well,
I'm
all depressed.
Pushing to bring this up.
I just thought it was hilarious. People screaming about how terrible their life was at a campus when they chose to go there. Not just chose to go there, but to put themselves in a tremendous amount of debt voluntarily in order to go there. I just thought that was deliciously ironic. But
look,
I'm going to ask you guys both a question.
I'm going to ask you guys both a question, and then, William, you can ask whatever your question is. But this is my show, so I get to ask the question during the intro. This is not Daniel Runs the News. This is Justin Runs this shit, okay?
Ladies and gentlemen, I am not a genius.
This has nothing to do with my IQ. I'm just being tyrannical right now. You've both lived on the East Coast and on the West Coast. You've both lived in L.A. and other places. Where is there more racism against minorities and black people specifically? Is it in LA or is it in the South?
Oh, it's LA, hands down.
LA, definitely.
All right. So to say that, oh, it's the most leftist, therefore it's the least racist, you know, in reality, that's not true. And I know you were being over the top, Daniel, but I really want to drive this point home.
Yeah, the elites, the especially the elite left, are wildly racist. And they have been forever. It's not a new thing. It's just evolved so that now they get to be applauded for their racism. And they get the people who they're racist against to vote for them, which has been the craziest trick in the history of politics. But
the craziest trick in the history of politics is that they've convinced people that trickle-down economics does not work, but there is trickle-down racism from them. All right, William, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to change it to a happier subject. If you scour YouTube right now, you can see folks from my small little hometown celebrating the 25th anniversary of my start into broadcasting in high school as a freshman, starting our video news in our high school. Railroad Television is 25 years old today. So there's a bunch of really, really shitty video quality. This is back in the VHS days. We actually took, just like this show, we actually had really good soundtrack. So people are starting to share around all the songs that we used on the show, which I thought was pretty pretty great.
So it's called Copyright Infringement, the show?
You know, that was, it was funny because it's due to the copyright algorithm for YouTube that I was able to quickly pull all the songs that we used on the various clips of the show that they've been posting.
So it's useful. Excellent. Very good. Well, congratulations, William. You started the internet.
And that
that's what I heard. I tuned out.
Dean, Al Gore.
Yes.
You started
and look where
internet,
you are now.
And that is why it all sounds racist. This all sounds racist.
Hmm.
That seems like the perfect transition into the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Patreon.com/TheMidSide. Before we get to the news, I want you to visit Patreon.com/TheMidSide and sign up to be a Patreon supporter. It really helps us. It allows you to give us a couple bucks every time we produce a show. And my goodness, that has been immensely helpful to offset costs of hosting and equipment and things like that. So patreon.com/TheMidSide. Tesla. We often talk about
first
Tesla.
First of all, can someone just give a dollar right now so I can get someone to figure out why there's static in the right ear of my headphones?
I've been hearing some static too. I hope that's not in the recording. But alas, I don't know what the hell's going on. Much like Elon Musk did not know what the hell was going on when he introduced Tesla's brand new car, or should I say truck, the Cybertruck.
You did use Joey air quotes for the truck, right?
Yeah, I did use air quotes. So Tesla unveiled its futuristic pickup truck at a promotional event in Los Angeles. But it didn't go quite as planned. CEO Elon Musk claimed the car was bulletproof against a 9mm handgun, something I think people in Los Angeles are particularly worried about, I guess. But when he got Tesla's chief designer to throw a metal ball at one of the armored windows, it shattered. Twice. So Musk exclaimed in front of the audience, "Oh my effing God, well, maybe that was a little too hard."
That's what she said.
There you go. Design lead Franz von Holzhausen gave it another shot and at another window, and again, the ball cracked the glass pretty badly. So this was embarrassing, to say the least, but I think Musk said something like, "We'll fix it in post," which is kind of funny. The truck
he's in
has...
L.A. He was playing to his crowd. Ha, 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 ha.
The quote-unquote truck also made the news because of its design, which is in the industry when something ends up being horrific, but you want to be nice about it, you just say it was a bold choice. And this, in fact, was the boldest of choices. The truck is highly angular, and unless you've seen a picture of it, I'm not even sure I could describe it properly. Save for someone who didn't know how to draw, they were told them to draw a truck, and they just drew like four or five straight lines and just made it this boxy-looking tank kind of vehicle and said, "Here, I drew a truck."
I believe, Daniel, I believe the truck was a secret unlockable item in GoldenEye on N64.
Yeah, that's true. It does have that N64 kind of resolution to it, right? Everything's a polygon. So, Justin, are you going to be first in line for Elon Musk's $39,900 Cybertruck?
You know what the sad part is? I actually looked at that price tag, and I must have been in L.A. too long, and I was like, well, that's not too bad.
That's where it starts. That's the non-bulletproof edition that they showed on stage, apparently.
Well, that's what I have to ask you, Daniel. Mm. I was having flashbacks to what you were saying about the Sonic redesign in the movie.
Yeah.
Come on, this was a marketing gimmick, right? This was an intentional fuck-up, right?
I don't know about the metal balls being intentional, maybe, but certainly the design is highly intentional. And certainly a marketing gimmick, because it looks like what people in the 1960s thought the 1980s were going to look like. That's kind of what it reminds me of. William, thinking about the group of people who buy trucks, i.e. construction workers and farmers and woodworkers and welders and people who, to use a phrase, do shit. Are any of those people going to buy this truck? quote-unquote truck?
I don't think so. I'm not sure how many how many of the supercharger stations are in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, or you know, in the middle, in between Toledo and Cincinnati in Ohio, or in the mountains in Kentucky or West Virginia.
So who is this quote unquote truck for?
This is for the virtue signalers of Los Angeles to look like. Basically, I think it's trying to make Cyberpunk 2077 look real.
Yeah, it turns out Ray Bradbury had a better vision for the future than Elon Musk. I don't know. This is what the future looks like. Count me out.
This is going backwards. For the people in Los Angeles who are both virtue signalers and fans of Judge Dredd starring Sylvester Stallone.
Yes, indeed. I don't know. I can't see anyone who does anything using this truck. This truck is for people who want to, basically elite upper class yuppies who want to look like they do things. So they drive a truck around and they might occasionally throw their Gucci suitcase in the back on the way to the airport just so they can show it off. But this truck is, it's got to be entirely useless. Especially compared to any Ford or Dodge or whatever that actually has thought about tailgates and step-ups and ladder. I mean, why a truck? Why, just not make this a stupid-looking car. Why a stupid-looking truck? That's the part I really don't get.
Isn't that Los Angeles in general? I mean, why do you need a fucking truck in Los Angeles at all? Like, I don't understand why people have trucks in this area.
Some Mexicans, but yeah.
And isn't everything you're saying, doesn't it just sum up Elon Musk and Tesla? Like, why is he based in Los Angeles to begin with? Why is Los Angeles his target market? None of it makes sense for what his purported mission and goals are. None of it lines up with there's no reality behind what he's supposedly doing with Tesla.
And this I think it's more nuanced than that. It's always been about trying, you know, with any treating cars like technology, which is, I think, the sort of rationale behind what he's doing. Of course, you want to sell expensive, high margin things to lower the cost of everything else so you can sell lower margin, inexpensive things, right? And I think that might be what they're trying to do with this truck, but you're right. It doesn't fit the existing market, right? So maybe this is a genius move. Maybe this is creating a new market of, as 4chan says, the cuck truck market. I mean, there are more soy boys in LA that would want to drive a truck and virtue signal about it, right? It's the perfect hipster vehicle. Wow. This is going to sell so well. I mean, they already sold 140,000 of them.
I've never heard a better description of a market in my life than that. That is the perfect market for this thing, for whatever the hell this is.
It's also the perfect insult now. You can just tell somebody, just go drive your cuck truck.
I love the pictures of them, like, driving ATVs, electric ATVs, of course, because there's plugs in the back. But I'm thinking my last camping trip, we went up to Big Bear, literally drove for, you know, an hour off of a road onto a set of dirt paths and just camped. We couldn't do that with the cuck truck. Like, there's not enough solar panels out there for it to charge.
But they have solar panels on the back of the place where you'd actually put stuff in the truck. So you can get some charge off this, apparently, but that also makes the truck part useless.
Literal months would it take to charge the cuck truck on a solar panel that big? Months.
I don't know what the hell is going on anymore. We have so much virtue signaling that it's hard to tell what is reality and what is just pure marketing nonsense anymore.
Daniel's that kid who was coming back from the dentist and his mom filmed him. What was that meme?
Oh, Yes.
Is this,
I know,
real life?
Is this real life? Is this just fantasy? And the sort of last thing I'll say about this is I understand that we're trying to cash in on some sort of weird nostalgia, like the 80s futuristic nostalgia of the current boomer generation, I guess, who is going to be driving this crap around. But if you're going to do that, at least do it. So did you see that Motorola released a new Razr phone?
And you're using the Joey air quotes again, right? New, quote unquote.
New. Well, what I'll say is that they at least innovated on it, right? So it looks exactly like the old Razr, save for the fact that it's a flip screen. So it's one continuous screen that folds in half. I'm sure much like the Samsung one, it will immediately shatter once you open and close it twice. But
as soon as you open and close it.
Yes, it'll immediately break in half. But at least they're trying, right? Like, I feel like this is lazy on Elon Musk's part. It was, let's go back and look at all the crap that people drew in the 80s that never came true, and then we'll make a product out of it. It's lazy. It's also terrible, but it's lazy on top of being terrible. Speaking of someone who is not lazy, but who may be terrible, on the other side of this virtue signaling nonsense is John Voight and Donald Trump and some crazy dancing going on in the White House. So John Voight took his, this is from a Huffington Post article, which is why there's so much horrible language in it. John Voight took his Donald Trump worship act to the White House on Thursday, dancing awkwardly for the president during a ceremony to receive a National Medal of Arts. Music from Voight's 1969 film Midnight Cowboy played in the East Room when the 80-year-old Oscar winner rose from his chair to provide an impromptu shuffle that earned a fist bump and a finger point from Trump, which from this president is the ultimate praise. Trump said, "I love having you here, especially since you are someone I really like." And then he passed him a note and it said, "Do you like me back? Circle yes or no." No, just kidding. The Los Angeles Times called the dance a cringeworthy interlude, and some people on social media agreed wholeheartedly. One person wrote that it was a clown dancing for a clown, and the rest talked about his bad relationship with his daughter, and things got very mean very quickly. So, Justin, I'll pass this on to you. Did you watch the video? Did you find it particularly cringeworthy?
I mean, I saw a GIF of the video on the Twitter. Does that count?
I guess that's how we consume news nowadays, so I guess that counts.
No, my point is I don't need to watch the video to know if it's cringeworthy or not. Of course they were going to label this dance cringeworthy. This, labeling this dance cringeworthy, and the reason I picked the Huffington Post article for this episode, has nothing to do with the dance itself, all right? It's an old white guy. How old is this guy?
80.
This guy's 80 years old, okay? He's 80 years old. He's a white guy. All right. And your wife has met him, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So you have secondhand. Your wife has firsthand.
He invited us to come out to his ranch and ride horses.
Okay. So there you go. So you have almost firsthand experience of the way an old white guy is like. All right. Imagine Clint Eastwood trying to dance on stage. All right. You're not going to get an old white guy to dance well on stage. So this has nothing to do with this. This is everything to do with the fact that when he accepted this award, he blasted Hollywood for how left-wing it is. So they had to go out on the attack against him. And they had to find something that was surface level to dismiss him for rather than discussing his ideas. This is the technique they always use. I'm not saying you have to agree with everything John Voight says, but he raised a valid point about Hollywood, so they had to find a way to discredit him, and this is just their way of discrediting him. I mean, isn't it a very, I don't know if this is the right word, but it's a very Foucaultian technique, Daniel?
Foucault. Wow. Digging deep on the French philosophers. Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a terministic screen through which you have to look at everything. So.
Right. I was referring to when he talked about the idea that, like, to get rid of someone and make their ideas not seem as important, you make them seem like a crazy person.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense.
Right, this is 100% what they're doing. This is what they always do. So there are other articles that forefronted what he said, right? I believe the Daily Mail had a long article that forefronted what he said. But if you look at the American press, especially sites like Huffington Post, they buried it. Where in this article does it appear what he said about Hollywood? Is it not at the bottom of the article?
Yeah.
This is intentional, people. This is how they control things. It's see-through, and I don't know how they're still getting away with it in the year 2019.
William, let me go a slightly different route with this, since Justin went one direction. Voight was there for a National Medal of Arts. Pretty much everyone there to receive the National Medal was some right-wing something or other, including Voight, who is just a right-wing person, not that he represents a right-wing industry, but is this just virtue signaling by the president?
Probably. Do you think maybe he actually likes these? I don't know. I mean, who even cares about this award? I don't know. But I want to know, is this... how dare the Huffington Post make fun of the dancing of my people? I mean, old white guys doing cringy dancing is sort of a... Is that the new white privilege? I need to add it to my list of white privileges? Being able to dance cringeworthy? Or having your dancing be called cringeworthy when you're 80?
It's true. I think you should add that to your list of privilege.
All right. Well, I'll make sure to add that to the list of privileges I check before each show.
That's right. I just don't get any of it, really. I watched it, and if I'm being honest, I didn't cringe. I mean, I have that propensity to feel embarrassed on behalf of people. That's why I can't watch any Ben Stiller movie. But I honestly did not get that from this video. The music was weird, and the video that showed you couldn't even hear the president speaking because the music was so loud, which was weird. And then John Voight gets up and does like, I don't know, 2.25 seconds of dancing, and then it's over. Whatever. This to me just, it's one of those things where you can just take this moment and you wouldn't even have to say, you wouldn't even have to tell me what the Huffington Post said about it, and you wouldn't have to tell me what the Daily Wire said about it. I could tell you what they both said about it. It's just one of those things. And that's a frightening prospect for quote-unquote journalism, much like the quote-unquote truck. Lots of similarities there, actually.
It's pronounced cuck truck, as we say.
I will not say that phrase despite thinking it is ridiculously funny because I don't want me saying that phrase captured as a drop for posterity.
I'm sure I can stitch something together.
But,
Cuck truck. Come on, make the drop for me. Do it.
If Wes Seiler has his way, there will be no posterity.
Has there ever been a man that is better summed up by the phrase cuck truck than Wes Seiler?
This is an Outside magazine, by the way, so he would perhaps drive that truck to...
By the way, I have to ask, William. We're just doing this out of order. Who cares? Is Outside a pun? Is it like a magazine for gay outdoorsmen?
I don't know.
I want to be clear. This is a legitimate question.
I'll research it while we read this story.
You research it, and that'll be a little foreshadowing for the audience. So, Wes Seiler, this is an article. I guess it's a self-reflective article, an opinion piece of sorts. He says, I've always struggled to combine the idea of personal responsibility with... the overwhelming need for human society to address the threat posed by climate change. He's always struggled with that, you know, since he was 2, 3, maybe even 4. He's really struggled with it. Since at least the 1970s, he continues, the massive energy corporations responsible for the vast majority of our carbon emissions have known about and done nothing to mitigate the harm they cause. He goes on, and so he talks about getting married and starting to plan for a family and then thinking about what he can do personally to reduce carbon emissions. And he says, for instance, that sure, he could forego his truck and maybe buy one of Elon Musk's, but that would only reduce carbon emissions a tiny bit, and it's such a huge sacrifice. So here's what they decided to do as a family. He can cut his carbon emissions by around 58 tons per year by not having children. So he decided to get a vasectomy. He says that's because there are simply too many humans on this planet. We've been told that driving an electric car or putting solar panels on our roofs will help, but that involves buying more stuff. which has a terrible impact on the environment, no matter how green the image. Two people deciding to make fewer humans eliminates the entire cycle of consumption that would fuel that kid's life. All those people ultimately represent the greatest climate change-related threat. Burning forests and flooded beach houses are sad and all, but it's the human conflict created by dwindling resources needed to sustain the population that stands to really change life on this planet. We're already fighting wars for oil. Many think wars for water will be next, and those are going to hit closer to home. So
I wish William had a drop of the WWE tag team The New Day right now, because I have a question to ask about the wars for water and people saying that.
Water?
Yeah, sorry, accent.
Your Worcester came out there for a second.
It did come out there. Because I have a question to ask about people saying this, right? Who is saying this? I've never heard that in my life.
There is a link, so I can follow you if you want.
I can link to anything on the internet.
Well, if you want to say people are saying it, you can find someone on the internet saying it, and you would be technically right. So, you can find some crazy person saying something about everything. But I got to read to you my favorite paragraph from this, and then you can respond. Because the paragraph, in addition to all the previous stuff, just contains every leftist, idiotic phrase and idea that exists. So, this is what he says. To close, it might not be enough to save the polar bear, and it might not prevent the next campfire, but this is the absolute biggest difference we can make. We need fewer humans, and getting there voluntarily will be an awful lot less painful than doing it with war, famine, and natural disaster. Justin, do you live on the same planet as this person? I mean, I know you literally do, but do you?
No, because you know what? When I read an article like this, I think that war would actually be quite enjoyable as a way of lowering the population.
I see. You took a left turn there that I didn't expect.
Well, you set me up for that one. Look, come on, man. We all know one of Bill Burr's original stand-up specials, right? This guy is one of those in-the-way people. Well, stop making this guy, people. Stop making this guy. No, I mean, in all seriousness, right? I don't encourage doxing, right? But if I Google your name and your Instagram comes up, it's not doxing. So I'm not going to say what this guy's Instagram URL is, but I'm going to say you can Google his name and his Instagram will come up. And his Instagram is very revealing, Daniel.
Maybe you're saying he didn't really need the vasectomy to not have children? Is that what you're saying? That it'd be a little bit tough for him to have children? Even without the vasectomy?
I mean, I don't know how in a relationship where there are two vaginas, it's possible to make a child. I think if his wife were to get pregnant and he didn't have a vasectomy, he would have to
it'd be by the other guy in the relationship?
Test. Yeah, exactly. He'd need a paternity test to be sure that he has to give all his money. And then he would probably give his money anyway.
So what you're saying is he should be first in line for Elon Musk's new vehicle, is what you're saying.
Yes, and we can get into that in a second because William has a very funny way of putting it. Because I didn't preface it, I just sent you guys the pictures on Instagram, and William can follow up with that. But the other point I want to get to here is the fucking retarded logic of this, where he's like, we're using too many carbon emissions already. In order to cut down on the carbon emissions we're putting in, we're getting rid of this hypothetical cost. It's like, we spend too much money on our budget. So, in order to save money, we will not buy that boat. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work. It's like, so we need, honey, we need to sit down. We need to have a conversation. How are we going to save money? We spend too much money. We're spending too much money. It's not sustainable. It's going to lead to war. We're going to have to fight the neighbors. And we don't want to have a bloody conflict with the neighbors because I'm a pussy and we'll lose. So how are we going to cut down on our saving? How are we going to cut down on our spending and save money? My suggestion is we don't buy a boat. You know what, honey? That's a really good idea. And I just want you to know that I invited the neighbor's husband over for dinner tonight. I hope you're okay with that.
Yes, ma'am. William. I have so many questions for you, William, but honestly, just say whatever you want.
No, please, just fire away. Now I don't even remember. I cracked so many jokes during the pre-show, just I don't remember which one you're talking about. So,
well, you thought I was sending you porn.
Oh, yeah. I saw the picture you sent. I was like, oh, I didn't know we were that close now. Sending me porn links.
So for the people in the show unaware, Justin will occasionally text us, and that's how we do show prep. Justin will text us random things. So we had this article.
Okay, first of all, I figure they're smart enough to figure it out. But
no,
also, if I don't give them any context and they think about it, I'm hoping that by forcing them to think about it, they'll actually prep.
So we got this article. We knew we were reading this article. And then, remind you, there's been no other communication about this article. Justin sends us pictures, one of which is a dude spooning a dude spooning a woman.
Spooning a dog.
Spooning a dog.
Yeah. The dog makes the picture. Bread Rocky.
With
Bread
no
Rocky,
context.
Sparky. Bread Rocky, Sparky.
Just so everyone knows, it's clearly like camping or something. But
sure,
they're all shirtless.
Okay. Including
Maybe
the
they're
dog. Outside. Yeah.
Including the dog.
Everyone's shirtless. And Justin doesn't say, hey, this is the guy from the article.
It's just some
It just sends
dude
us the photo.
Yeah.
And then we're both like, what are we supposed to do with this? I mean, I know what you're doing with it, but what are we supposed to do with it? So that's how Justin does show prep, everyone. Sending us.
So my question to you, Justin, is did Harambe have to die? Because that's the other picture you sent.
Yeah, oh, this guy was on TV doing an interview about Harambe?
Yeah, with Dr. Drew. He was on Dr. Drew's show and asked, did Harambe have to die?
Okay.
Because you know what he did? He took his dick out for Harambe.
the article...
the gift that just keeps giving.
It's hysterical, but we should take at least 30 seconds to make sure that we denounce... this guy would be, he would probably consider himself progressive and his ideas are considered progressive. But as we pointed out on the show before, these ideas couldn't be older. These are some of the oldest ideas that humans have held, and they have always been wrong. The idea that we have too many people, that people are what make the planet worse, that we're using too many resources, that fewer
What's
people
that
would be
the
better.
Guy that starts with an M.
Malthus, Thomas Malthus, who just made up whole cloth this idea of overpopulation, with no evidence whatsoever to back it up, and it just caught on like wildfire. So that people who hate other humans can use that reasoning to exterminate them. Now, I'm not saying this guy wants to exterminate people, but obviously the logical next step of we should stop having children voluntarily is I should make you stop having children because you won't do it voluntarily. It doesn't take that big of a logical leap. But this is all literal nonsense.
There's actually
nonsense.
There's actually a follower on Twitter, John Buck, who has been writing about this and tweeting about it forever. And sorry, John, I thought you were crazy for a while, because he's been on this for years. And it's the concept of antinatalism, the idea that it's morally wrong to have children.
Yeah.
And now we're starting to see the idea of antinatalism become mainstream. So I think we all should perhaps tip our hat to John Buck, who was ahead of the curve on this one, seeing this one coming.
Well, yes, Daniel, I'm particularly torn, right? Because it's going to be a challenge for me to someday have children. So seeing someone just so flippant with it is
it's not
going to
stop you from
coin.
Trying.
Yeah, and then but then there's the other side of that coin. This is like a self-selecting sort of crew, right? So do I really want that kind of parent to have children? Right, like. There are others who will have children and actually value their children, so the world will probably be better off.
That's the old abortion argument. That's the old abortion argument, the idea of, okay, legalize abortion. It's only all the leftists that are going to be having them anyway.
Well, hey, there's something to that.
Now, look, again, if that's where this ended, meaning if people just said, I'm going to choose not to have children for the sake of the planet, I would be the first to applaud. But I think it doesn't stop there, because it hasn't stopped there historically when we talk about things like overpopulation. There were questions about overpopulation in the late 1800s, and then the early 1900s, we were forcibly sterilizing people because we decided that they were the type of people who shouldn't be having children because of overpopulation.
That was through buying them a cuck truck, right?
That's right, and no one would sleep with them again. No, it wasn't. And we forcibly sterilized millions of people around the globe, most of whom were minorities or people who were poor and disadvantaged for the sake of the elite. And we're starting to see that cycle happen again. Now we're in the early portion of that cycle, which is people saying, yeah, you shouldn't have children for the sake of overpopulation on the planet. But again, it is not a difficult leap to make to say, well, I've made this choice and now I'm going to make this choice for you. Because you are actually the ones who shouldn't be having children, you evil libertarian, capitalist, conservative, MAGA hat wearing Nazi. You're the ones who shouldn't be having children.
Don't forget fascist.
Fascist. Exactly. So, yes, if it stopped here, hooray, stupid people won't be having children. But it never stops there. Never stops there.
Yeah, that's kind of the far left's modus operandi, right? It's not that it's the virtue signaling, which is entertaining, but when it becomes, okay, now we're going to force everyone else to also signal this virtue, that's when it turns to the evil.
Oh, I thought the far left's MO was to kill someone and then claim it's a suicide.
Well, have I got some news for you? Attorney General Barr is here to ruin your memes, because despite the internet success of the Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself meme, the Attorney General of the United States said recently that he did, in fact, kill himself. So and that his suicide was the result of, quote, a perfect storm of screw ups. In an interview with the Associated Press, Barr said his concerns were prompted by the numerous irregularities at the New York jail where Epstein was being held. But he said after the FBI and the Justice Department's Inspector General continued to investigate, he realized there was a series of mistakes made that gave Epstein the chance to take his own life. Quote, I can understand people who immediately, whose minds went to the sort of worst case scenario because it was a perfect storm of screw-ups, he told the Associated Press. So there are even people being charged for this. The guards, for instance, who were supposed to be watching him, who instead were shopping for furniture and surfing the internet, they're being charged, but their attorney says they're being scapegoated.
Wait, were they really shopping for furniture on the internet?
I don't know. It's something the article says. It's a little bit weird. Epstein was placed on suicide watch after he was found July 23rd on his cell floor with bruises on his neck, but was taken off the heightened security watch about a week before his death, meaning he was less closely monitored but still supposed to be checked on every 30 minutes. Of course, he was not. He also didn't have a cellmate. The cameras didn't work. So many things. But Barr says, don't worry. I've looked into it. And it was just a huge amount of screw-ups. Justin, will this convince anyone of anything?
Hopefully it lets people know how much the government is lying to them and how far we've moved away from for the people, by the people. I mean, look, I don't believe in conspiracy theories, but we all know I'm sort of like on the edge there, right? But this is like the most obvious conspiracy theory in the history of conspiracy theories, right? I mean, obviously he didn't kill himself, right?
I'm on
which
board
will get us
that,
banned
honestly.
From the internet faster, saying the leaker's name or saying Epstein killed himself?
Just hit the drop. Jesus.
Which one?
You didn't get the drop.
I didn't drop the leaker's name. I don't want us to get us kicked off of Apple Podcasts.
Nobody listens to the show to get us kicked off of Apple Podcasts. Come on, you know
you
that.
Could say the name live.
I don't remember the name.
How would you rate this lie? Would you give it three or
That's
four?
How the internet wins.
Jarmelas.
There we go.
Look, look, this is obviously, look, this is a Clinton lie, okay? This is, if anything, this just convinces me the Clintons are involved in this somehow. Because this goes down to, like, I did not have sex with that woman, Monica Lewinsky, and it depends on what your definition of is. That is the level of lying that this incompetence is. And what's crazy that people aren't saying is, this is a right-wing guy, right? Supposedly, this is part of Trump's administration, and he's participating in this lie. If you think any of this is separate, if you think there's actually any sort of separation of the system, if you think there's any division in this country besides the government and the elite who control it and the rest of us, then you don't know what's going on. And this just reveals it. The idea that he thinks he can say, oh, well, it was just a series of screw-ups and it led to a suicide is filled with contempt. He thinks you're stupid enough to fall for that lie. And let's say for a second that we accept that lie is the truth. So then the government's that incompetent?
Yes.
So these are our choices. These are our choices. Either the government is fucking evil or the government is completely fucking incompetent. Either way, with this statement, we lose, ladies and gentlemen. We lose.
It is quite literally stupid or liar at this point. But William, look, I do believe there are lots of things that we don't know about the Epstein thing. And it to me, it still appears as if he probably was not. He probably did not kill himself, in my opinion. But if there was one believable angle to this story, it would be that the government is so wildly incompetent that they allowed him to kill himself. So is that the only thing Barr has going for this?
I don't want to live on this planet anymore.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. I can completely see someone, both could be true. Either the government could be completely incompetent, which we pretty much know is true. Have you been to the California DMV? But the other side of it is, couldn't someone more easily manipulate an incompetent government? I mean, why was he in this prison cell? Why were these guards on duty? There's a lot of meat for conspiracy theorists on this story. But, yeah, I mean, it, like Justin was saying, it doesn't matter incompetence or quote-unquote conspiracy. We'll have to see if anything further develops, right? We're seeing all these charges against the government officials, but what about the Epstein investigation itself and those connected with him?
Yeah, that's over. We'll never learn anything else about it, unfortunately. The government can't even find the one woman who he was associated with who was basically managing the whole thing. This is why, by the way, this is a very meta point, and for people listening who've been listening for a while will be totally obvious. It's why I don't trust the government to do anything. Anything! They have basic functions that they have to do by the nature of what a government is, police, courts, military. But it's why I don't trust them to run a post office. It's why I don't trust them to run healthcare. It's why they should not be in charge of food and water and transportation and any of the things that are essential to well-being, because they are a perfect storm of screw-ups in just about every element of their being. Or if they're not that, they're conspiratorial. They're ganging up against us. They're corrupt. They're all the things we don't want them to be. So your choices are idiocy,
stupid
or corruption.
Liar.
Yes, stupid or liar.
And here's
and so
the thing. About
they should
the...
be in charge of as few things as possible because of that.
Right. And here's the thing, Daniel, with what you're saying about even just the way things are set up. Even if there are, and I'm speaking from firsthand experience here, even if there are competent, well-meaning people within the system, the way the system is set up makes it so whatever value they're contributing is minimized as much as possible. That's not even an intentional design of the system. It's just the way it's set up, the amount of bureaucracy makes their impact as minimal as possible. Because I've seen, as people know, I work for the state government. I have seen some people, some engineers in specific, who are very competent and very well-meaning. And their contributions are minimized as much as possible based upon the system.
Yep, there is no incentive for greatness. There's only incentive for stupidity and lying.
Right, and that's what I'm saying, is even these people are, without incentive, these people are still trying for greatness, and there's just no way they can succeed.
Yep. Super optimistic.
Speaking of being super pessimistic and making it so things seem like there's no way of succeeding, I'm going to review a movie in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on. As I say every week, if you would like to continue this conversation after you've listened to the episode and until you listen to the next episode, you should join our Discord channel via our website, themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast. There's a lot of content that's posted in there that's not on the show. This week we discussed, journalism excellence worldwide and whether it is a parody or not, right? I think that was that the, what the acronym stands for?
Something like that. It's journalism EW. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that whole thing. So that was going along the internet. We talked about that. There's other stuff that William has put in there. Love when listeners, when midsiders out there contribute as well, because it makes the show even better. This week, I want to review a movie that I was kind of avoiding out of, some misguided loyalty to Adam Carolla, I think. Ford versus Ferrari. I sort of didn't want to see it because it kind of annoyed me that he made the 24-hour war and they told him it wasn't a good story. And then once he made it, they made this movie. But I finally gave in. I saw it because it was either that or Frozen 2 to review this week. And I didn't really want to see Frozen 2. And plus, I really like Christian Bale. And of course, Christian Bale's performance is wonderful. Can't knock Christian Bale. Matt Damon's pretty good in this. The performances are pretty good in this. But this movie... So I don't get annoyed with movies very often anymore. Like, there are some terrible movies, right? Like, Booksmart was terrible. But I didn't get, like, annoyed with that. I was just like, that's a fucking terrible movie. But this movie, I got so annoyed at, okay? So, Daniel, William, you know the general story of this movie, correct? Where it's Ford versus Ferrari. Ferrari always wins Le Mans because they were a racing company. And Ford is trying to raise their slumping sales.
Yeah, I watched the 24-hour war, and I really enjoyed it.
Right, so go watch that. They're trying to raise their slumping sales, Daniel, so what do?
They enter Le Mans, the race, and they want to beat them.
Right, and they decide they're going to make a car that's better than Ferrari, and they're going to win Le Mans, right?
Yep.
I may have mispronounced that. So that's what this story is about, right? And it's about how they got the Shelby Motor Company involved, and Shelby's a former racer who won Le Mans, and then there's the racer, I can't remember his name, but he's played by Christian Bale. And it's all about, you know, the push-pull with the bureaucracy of the company of Ford versus the individualism and the productivity of Shelby and his driver, played by Christian Bale. And Henry Ford II is in there, and there's elements of stuff about the fact that he's Henry Ford II and not Henry Ford, and what that says about, you know, when a company's handed down from, like, a genius for, like Steve Jobs to Tim Cook, especially when it's nepotistic, you know, when it's a son or something like that. So there's a lot of interesting things going on in this movie. There's also the element of selfishness, right, where they keep saying the driver, who's clearly the best driver in the world, and as Bill Belichick would say, it doesn't matter how well I design the plays, the players have to execute on the field. And that's what Matt Damon, his character Shelby, tells the Ford company. You want to know what money can't buy? It's the driver. You can make the best car in the world. If you don't have the driver, that intangible quality, you can't win. Well, then, of course, the driver is basically essentially called too selfish and individualistic. So the movie plays with a lot of these things. But then this movie was very confusing for a long time for me. So the way it opens is very strange. This movie opens with Matt Damon's character, who isn't the racer at the end, that's Christian Bale, at the doctor's office, and he's remembering when he won Le Mans, and then you find out he can't race anymore because one of his heart valves is gone, which, get it, it's a metaphor, because, like, if the car breaks down and it can't race anymore and his heart valve is shot the way, like, a part on a car can be shot, get it, it's clever writing, and he has to have heart pills. But then the rest of the movie is, like, a pretty good movie about, like, trying to build a racing car with all the interesting ideas in it. So then you get to the end of Le Mans, and it's over, and you find out what happened and everything, and even the way that ending ends is sort of disappointing. And then the next scene afterwards, they're testing for the next year. And you're like, why is this movie still going? Why are they showing testing for the next year? And all of a sudden, the car blows up and Christian Bale's character dies. But then it literally goes into the next scene, and they show a test car pull up, and, like, they hesitate. And I thought Christian Bale's character was going to get out of the car. Like, I didn't, like, the way it was set up, like, I didn't legitimately believe he was dead. And then the final scene in the movie is Matt Damon going and having a conversation with the 15-year-old kid of Christian Bale's character. And it's all this existential crap about how life is precious and shouldn't be taken for granted and becoming too obsessed with things. So this movie is, it's like a decent sports movie, like an above average B sports movie. But on either side of it, this Hollywood crap is put on it, is bookended on it as the framing device. And it just makes it very unpalatable. It makes it so when you leave the movie, you're like, why did they have to kill him? Why did they have to have that final scene? I mean, the ending of the race was disappointing enough. You could argue there are, you could interpret it either way, but you could argue that it's very anti-individualistic and anti-selfishness. That would be an interesting discussion to have. But that's all moot with the way the whole fucking thing ends with those bookends. It leaves you with a bad feeling. You're like, why did they have to kill him off? Why did they have to have this dark ending? Here's this movie about this accomplishment by the Ford Motor Company, and that's what you make it about? I mean, look, I looked it up afterwards, and the guy did legitimately die in real life. But that's what we have to look at with storytelling here. We have to look at the choices the artists are making. What are the choices the director is making? What are the choices the writer is making? What are the choices the producers are making? And everyone involved in this movie was complicit in making the choice to put this bookend on the movie. Everyone thought that was a good idea. And I don't want to say everyone. You know, the actors are just doing what they're told. The grips are doing what they're told, right? I don't want to make it seem like everyone. But the majority of people and the decision makers made a choice. And that choice is deeply revealing about themselves. And Daniel said pre-show to me that the movie's getting a lot of Oscar buzz. Well, Daniel, do you understand now why it's getting the Oscar buzz?
Yeah, because it, despite the fact that you're trying to do this heroic story, it succumbs to naturalism.
It was like they were trying to tackle it's not naturalism, though, because the choices of the characters in the movie matter, and the movie emphasizes their choices. Like I said, in the middle, besides those two bookends, those choices matter. But it was literally like, it's like, remember when I watched the Joker movie and I was like, people are trying to build this up to something it's not, and it's like a movie trying to be smart, but it's not actually smart? This is the same thing. It was like they wrote a script and they were like, okay, how do we make this more like it's supposed to be rather than what it is? We need to make this good art. We don't just need to make art we think is good. Do you understand the difference between those two things I just said?
I think so. And I haven't seen the movie, so I'm not saying that the movie is naturalistic in its character and universe and plot. But remember, we always talk about this sort of Z-axis of naturalism and romanticism, where part of it is your choice in how you tell your choice in the selection of what happens in the story, not the character's choices within the story. And so my point is that all the things you talked about, Justin, about the weird ending to the race and his dying and the heart valve thing, that just is all literally what happens in real life. And instead of making choices to emphasize things in the story and romanticize literally what happened in real life, they just chose to do all the things that happened in real life, even if they did them in a good way. That's kind of what I'm getting at.
Right.
They didn't need to include all of those things.
Well, no, 100%. I personally would have changed the ending of the race. I would have had him inch ahead of the guy at the end, just so he still got the win. I would have done that, personally. I know that's not what happened in reality, but that's what I would have had him done rather than get screwed the way he did. I wouldn't have had the framing device at all. That would have been the end of it. I would have ended it on that heroic note. Just that simple choice. And yeah, you're 100% correct. And that's what I'm saying when I'm saying they're trying to make good art rather than make art they think is good. What I'm saying is they're following the formula of what they think they're supposed to follow to make good art. It's a second-handed way of making art where it's like, okay, we're going to portray what actually happened in the story because that's what we do in stories like this. And then we're going to give it some supposedly introspective existential statement on life and what life is. And because of that, it will be high quality art. That is what high art is.
Yeah.
All right, William, do you have any thoughts to say on this?
Go watch the 24-Hour War and the Shelby American documentary and get the better version of this story.
Indeed. I think that's a great way of putting it because I think we're probably not going to be recommending a lot of other things to watch as we head into Trailer Takedown. As always, the trailers are posted on the website Saturday mornings at the latest. And then you can go to themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast, and you can watch trailers before the episode, after the episode, or personally, as I would do it, during the episode, watch a trailer and then hear us talk about it. Watch a trailer and then hear us talk about it.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
Hunters is an Amazon Prime original series brought to you by Jordan Peele. So you guys know what it's about, right?
Look at racism?
Racism, correct. If there was ever a greater proof that what Armand White said about Jordan Peele was correct, it was this show. He is obviously trading in whatever the conventional current ideas of the extreme left are in order to get clout from them, in order to get money from them. That is all he is doing. This show is about a group of people hunting Nazis. And it starts with Al Pacino. This trailer starts with Al Pacino giving this big speech about the importance of essentially hunting Nazis. First of all, didn't Quentin Tarantino already do this movie? Wasn't this movie called Inglourious Bastards? I'm pretty sure. Am I wrong about that?
A little bit.
Second of all, this doesn't look terrible. I'm not going to be like, this show looks terrible. Well, I just question why now? And I just told you why now. It's just everything about this makes me want to reject it. So I could go on and on about this, but fuck Jordan Peele. Fuck this show. Tackle. Daniel?
What more is there to be said, aside from the fact that I'm even going to go further and say it doesn't even look good? Al Pacino is a revered actor, and he should be for things that he does well. But if you're going to give him this accent and make him play this character that he's not known for playing, it's just going to be – it just looks like Al Pacino in a bad wig, and the performance is not great, and the themes are not great. I can't. Tackle.
William?
I was completely thrown by this movie. I have no idea. I didn't really figure it out until about halfway through. I was like, oh, we're fighting Nazis. So this is Punch a Nazi the movie? Tackle?
So here's the thing, guys. I hate talking about stuff like this because us getting upset about this could very easily be construed as we're pro-Nazi. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah. Because that's the thing where it's like, who said, was it Adam Carolla who says it all the time? It's like, I don't need to say every 15 minutes that I'm anti-racism. That should be the assumption. Because we don't, why do we have to say we're anti-Nazi when we're reviewing a movie like this? Who isn't anti-Nazi? It's totally ludicrous. The movie, the series, or whatever the hell it is, looks terrible.
Well, and we all know the Iron Cross is a Nazi symbol. because they were showing that.
I mean, if you want to watch, look, there are movies. I feel even stupid doing this kind of thing because it feels like a I have a black friend moment. But if you want to watch movies where
breaking news, you have a black friend?
Nazis get taken down, or in this case, it's not Nazis; it's Stasi, it's Russian communist officers. Watch The Lives of Others, which is a phenomenally good movie against those ideas of fascism and whatever. Or watch Inglourious Basterds, which is also an excellent movie.
Except
don't watch this
fucking
woke
long-ass bar scene in the basement. Fuck, that
love
scene
it.
Went on forever.
Love it.
That opening scene, though, tremendous.
Oh, my good God. Yeah.
Inglourious Basterds. Yeah, honestly, that's the review of this, right? Watch Inglourious Basterds. Quentin Tarantino did it. He did it better. Fuck off with this movie. Let's move on.
Second trailer.
Antebellum is a horror movie about, like, a writer who wakes up in the antebellum South, but I think I should add that she's black, so the antebellum South is scary because she's black. I don't understand this movie at all. And Daniel, I think you're gonna have to be saying a lot of "I have a black friend" because I this is, they say it's from the people who did Get Out and Us, and it's like they're just all, now it's not even Jordan Peele trading in this anymore, now the production companies are trading in this as well. It's just horror has gone off the rails now. Horror used to be like a refuge in this culture, and they've even gotten down to horror now. I have a black friend. Tackle. Daniel?
I hate horror movies in the first place, and horror movies about wokeness are right out. I just can't. Tackle.
Tackle.
Everything is political, including horror. Tackle.
The thing that's crazy to me about this trailer especially is, like, there's nothing especially scary in the trailer itself. It's just, like, literally what's supposed to be scary is, oh, my God, she's a black woman in the post-Civil War South. Oh, my God.
It's all the scary music, though. It's got all the visual and auditory tropes, right? It's very platonically made, right? Like, here's all the pieces of a horror movie, but we're actually telling a political story.
It would literally be like, oh my God, if you had all the music and all the visual tropes that you're talking about, William, and like they were having afternoon tea and it was supposed to be a horror movie.
But it's a thing again where if you want to see the horrors of slavery and stories about the South, there are a billion movies that have done it and done it well. Amistad, Roots. What was the other one I was going to say? Ken Burns, the Civil War documentary. Phenomenal. But this just looks like woke nonsense.
A documentary. Get out of here.
Ken Burns is fantastic. You shut your mouth.
Third trailer.
Avenue 5 is a sci-fi parody series starring Hugh Laurie. In it, Hugh Laurie is captain of a ship in a spaceship that things seem to be going wrong on. This looks like a cross between Galaxy Quest and Titanic. Daniel will probably appreciate the show because it looks like it's from one of the people who made Veep. I thought this trailer looked great. I thought this was like the perfect post-house role for Hugh Laurie. This is one of the few trailers I've seen on this show in the last few years that I was like, wow, I actually legitimately want to see this. Like, it's not like I have no hesitance of this at all. There's nothing I'm worried about with this. So this, for me, hits my sweet spot. Hugh Laurie, sci-fi, parody, adult. This just hits my sweet spot. Tackle.
Mm.
What?
Hug.
Oh, sorry, I meant hug. I said the wrong
He's tackling Hugh Laurie. I totally got it. He's got it. That's why I did the central one.
The best part is? William understood my brain better than I understood with his drop. Yes. Because I was so used to tackling the first two because they made me so angry that I said tackle without meaning to.
You were on a tackle roll.
It's that CTE, man.
Tackle.
It's the CTE.
Must be. from all your soccer years.
Wrestling, I got dropped on the mat a few times.
Oh, I forgot about the wrestling. Yeah. Yeah.
There were legitimately a few times my head hit the mat and I did legitimately see stars. That's a real thing.
Yep. Yeah, this looks phenomenal, and from the writers of Veep, and it has some of the stars from their original British shows as well, who were hysterical. But be clear, he's not just on a spaceship, he's on like a space cruise liner, like he's the captain of a cruise ship, essentially, in space.
I said meets the Titanic. That was understood for our smart listeners.
It's a little self-referential, one of the first
Stop
jokes is...
Stop dumbing the show down.
No, I will always dumb the show down. That's what I do. It's a little self-referential. One of the first jokes is the captain walking by and one of the passengers being like, set your phasers to fun.
That was funny. And, I laughed.
I laughed too, because it's very aware. So I'm in. Hugh Laurie's fantastic in just about everything he does, and it's getting back to his comedy roots. Love that about Hugh Laurie. So
White House wasn't a comedy?
It was a certain kind of comedy, but it was really a drama. But going back to like a little bit of Fry and Laurie... type of, I mean, it's not that silly, but going back to what House did very well for a long time, Hugh Laurie did very well for a long time. Major hug.
Hug.
William?
You know, I'm so desperate for sci-fi, so you know I'm going to hug this. It looks entertaining. Like Justin, I want to tackle Hugh Laurie, so hug.
Hug.
I can't get mad at William for that, but that's not why I said that. Although I just want to say that, and this is a spoiler for the next one, but I only put this one in here because I didn't want us to tackle everything, and I needed something that was a hug, so.
Final trailer.
The Call of the Wild is an adaptation of the book by Jack London starring... what's his name? Harrison Ford. I didn't even remember. Look, this trailer, man. Like, oh my god. All right, I want to be very clear about something. Call of the Wild is not a difficult book to parse, okay? Thematically, it's not difficult to understand. I like to call Call of the Wild Breaking Bad for dogs, because that's what it's about, all right? It's about this dog is pampered, and he goes into nature, and he becomes a wild beast, and it's all about how nature is superior to man. Right, that's what Jack London loves writing about, right? How man is evil and nature is superior to man. And that's what this book is about. What this book is not about is a family-friendly story about the relationship between a man and his dog as they go on an adventure in the Alaskan wilderness. However, that is what this movie is about. And then on top of it, they were like, you know what we should do? We should make the face of the dog CG. There is nothing in this trailer that would make Jack London happy. And I am defending Jack London at this point. Let me put it that way, okay? Now, yeah. I want to be clear. Jack London's a talented writer. He just erred towards naturalism and shit themes. But he had talent. Like I said, he had themes, he had ideas in his books. This is an injustice to Jack London. And this is just a shit movie overall, especially when you add in the fact that Harrison Ford obviously doesn't give a shit anymore.
Why is he even doing this?
Sometimes I think he's the anti-Clint Eastwood and he's making movies as he gets older just to troll people. Like, he's like, Clint Eastwood's out there showing you can make good movies as an old man. I'm just going to fuck with people and make bad movies as an old man. I don't know. I just really want to hear the two of you rant about this at length. Tackle.
I have to admit, my first thought when I saw this very old-looking Harrison Ford and then this creature come up, I thought, this new adaptation of Solo, Chewbacca looks terrible. They really missed the mark on Chewbacca. I don't know what even to do with this. It's not new. It's not a remake. Did they make a movie of The Call of the Wild? I don't think they did. But it also doesn't
they
look like...
They couldn't make a CG dog before. Why would they make the movie? If the dog can't be CG, why make the movie?
Well, that's my thing. Is like, we've done movies about animals going on adventures. Do you remember Milo and Otis? None of that was CGI. And that worked.
Can
you
I
know,
just say... I gotta stop
audience.
You.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Milo and Otis has been forgotten as a cultural touchstone is a fucking tragedy. Okay?
Yes, it is. It was fantastic.
That movie and Homeward Bound?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Everyone needs CGI dog face. This dog is literally wearing dog face. I hope you realize that. And Harrison Ford should be ashamed of himself for this petism or whatever it would be called. This looks god-awful, and Harrison Ford should be ashamed of himself. Tackle.
They CGI'd the wrong character.
Tackle.
I just who was like we're gonna take Call of the Wild and we're gonna make it a family friendly adventure story. Like what
the CGI
fucking
is so awful. You're missing the whole point. You talk about cringeworthy. The CGI was so awful. I didn't watch any of the Disney CGI. So for animals that I can only imagine this is what watching Lion King was like.
No, this is like a lot worse than that. A lot worse than that.
Oh, shocking.
Terrible.
All right. Let's move away from something terrible to talk about something amazing. Football. Bill, check your premises.
Go talk to the geniuses that are online. What was the condition to rule and control? The media sells it, and you leave the role. Metal wounds still screaming, driving me insane. I'm going off the rails on a crazy train. I'm going off the rails on a crazy train.
Recorded during the Week 12 early games, it's time to Belichick your premises. And there's nothing really going on in the games right now. I'm kind of scrolling through the scores here, the scoreboard. There's nothing really interesting worth talking about in those games. There's a lot of 0-0 games, a lot of 3-0, 3-0 games. Not interesting at all. And we're always in a tough position with the recording schedule, Daniel and William, because I want to talk about the Patriots game, but by the time people hear about this, hear the episode, the game will be over, so all the pregame talk will be useless. So is there anything we can say about the game today as we're recording? You'll have heard this. It'll be yesterday or a few days ago when you're hearing this. that we can say about that will be worthwhile post-show. For me, I just want to note that the number of injuries, I think, could play a significant amount. I mean, we don't know if Mohamed Sanu is going to play. Philip Dorsett's out with a concussion. They're saying Brady couldn't even finish practice on Friday. I don't believe that. But so just the number of injuries could play huge into the game. And also the other thing that could play huge into the game is that Isaiah Wynn is back for the first time. And now there's an actual starting caliber left tackle on the Patriots offensive line, which could change the entire offensive line, the pass blocking and the run blocking. So the offense could be very different due to one player.
The run blocking hopefully will be much improved, but who's he going to throw the ball to at this point? You got N'Keal Harry and Jacoby Meyer. Those are his two uninjured receivers.
Julian Edelman. I mean, he's hurt, but he'll play because he's Julian Edelman.
He'll play, of course, but he is injured. So,
yeah, somebody and texted me that this morning. My friend, he was like, is this the beginning of the end for the GOAT? Where, what do you say? The age-related injury-riddled decline of the GOAT. And then he sent me a picture of a GOAT climbing a mountain, and he was like hanging on by a thread. And then he asked me, is he playing hurt? And I was like, they all play hurt all the time. It's the NFL. Like, this is all blown out of proportion.
Yeah. I guess we've seen Tom Brady do more with less, so wouldn't be surprised, but in his own words, last week he said he was playing miserably lately, so unclear if that's due to him, due to the offensive line, due to the lack of talent around him, any number of things. I will say that today's being boasted as a huge game for the Patriots, and obviously if they lost and Ravens won, that would change who's first place in the AFC overall, and the Ravens have the tiebreaker. So that could have long-term implications, but let's say they do lose and they end the season 14-2 or 13-3. Are we going to write that off as some horrible, awful season. So I do think we have to keep the whole thing in context. The Cowboys have the number one total offense in the league, so clearly it's possible that they lose today. It's possible they lose every week. Just let's not... remember last year when every single week was doom and gloom, Justin? I know we talked about this before, I think, but like they lost to the Steelers, and I think every Patriots fan in the entire world was throwing their hands up in the air and saying, it's over. That's the end. Bye, Tom Brady. Bye, Bill Belichick.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. I said that at that game because it was the same thing as the Ravens game this year, except worse. And that's what people don't realize. Like, I got pissed about the Ravens game this year, right? Where it was just one of those, when the Patriots lose, it's just like everything, it's the same kind of things that go wrong, right? Bad calls, there's a stupid intentional grounding call, there's a couple undisciplined plays, then there's a random turnover that doesn't usually happen that's unlucky. That's what tends to happen every time they lose. And the Steelers game was that on steroids, especially because, unlike the Ravens this year, the Steelers had no skills at all. Right, the Ravens this year, like, Lamar Jackson's playing out of his fucking mind. They have a really good running game. They have the typical Ravens defense. So you can understand how they could win, especially because it was in Baltimore. And even though that game was in Pittsburgh, you still watch that game and you're like, there's no way the Patriots should be losing this game. They're just, the Steelers are a terrible team. And then they didn't even make the playoffs. And right, because of that, it seemed like such an extreme, like, cliff game that it just seemed like the end. And this is different from like the Kansas City game in that week four a couple of years ago where they smoked the Patriots after Hightower went down, and then the run defense was nothing when Hightower went down in the middle of the game. If something like that happens, you can be like, oh, okay, I understand what happened. But sometimes there are those games every once in a while. And your point is very well taken. This team is still 9-1. And it's like people seem to forget that. They're still 9-1. Even if they lose this week, they very well could get the number two seed, right? The only reason there are big games from now on is the next three games are the Cowboys, Texans, and Chiefs. And if they can get through those three games undefeated, well, then they play the Bengals, the Bills, and the Dolphins. So the odds of them going the rest of the season without losing would be very high. And because they lost to the Ravens, they have no margin for error is basically the issue, unless the Ravens lose, which leaves us in the unenviable position of cheering for the Rams on Monday night. So it seems like a bigger deal.
No one cheers for the Rams.
Right. It seems like a bigger deal than it is, because to have the AFC Championship game in Gillette is a big advantage. And that makes this game seem even bigger because the game is in Gillette. So that's a huge advantage. Like, if this was in Dallas, I would not feel good about the Patriots' chances. In fact, for some reason, my brain told me it was in Dallas. And then when I looked this morning, I saw it was in New England. I was like, oh, we got a really good chance now. I probably would not pick the Patriots if this game, due to the injuries, I would not pick the Patriots if this game was in Dallas. But because it's in New England, especially it's supposed to rain, I believe that they can grind out a running victory in this game.
I still think it has the makings of one of those games that could be a loss for them because of the various pieces that aren't there, and they're going to be a little bit too one-dimensional on offense. But we'll see. We don't, no need to speculate, because by the time you've already heard this, you'll know the outcome, and we will not. Well, we will know it tomorrow when you... No, never mind. Time! William, one thing we should maybe transition into is what this is all going to look like moving forward. And Justin, you brought up an article by the Greenwich Times about a new generation of elite quarterbacks. So I'm sort of curious about William in particular, because he's not as hardcore Patriots as we are, about the quote-unquote new generation of elite quarterbacks, and if you've been impressed by all of them, some of them, none of them, one of them.
The article specifically mentions Mahomes, Lamar Jackson, Deshaun Watson. I think that's it. I don't know who else they mentioned, but those were the big three.
I don't know. When I read that article, it sort of sounded like more marketing than truth. Does that make sense? Like it seemed like more like we need to drum up these folks as stars and look how different they are. But I think the game of football is constantly evolving, and so is it really that these elite quarterbacks are sort of coming out of nowhere, or is this, you know, the college system has responded to the new way the NFL is playing football, and now you're producing better quarterbacks.
It's an interesting thought. I'll take a slightly different angle on it, Justin, which is let's not be putting anyone in the Hall of Fame just yet. All these players, and all of them have been playing out of their mind recently, have all shown that they're highly talented. But one of the key things, one of the things we've ached on Belichick Your Premises for years that we've done this, Justin, is longevity. How can you do this over time? Everyone remembers RG3 decimated the league 1 year, and then what happened? So, or anyone when Matt Cassel did phenomenally well with the Patriots 1 year, and then what happened? The point is, can you have sustained success as people, as defensive coordinators, as head coaches learn you and your skills and your tendencies? Can you continue to be successful when people are game planning for you in certain ways? That was what I said in the early season was the number one question about the Ravens offense, which is once people get enough game film, can they still win? So before we put any of these folks in the category of quote unquote elite quarterback, and the word elite is so one of those horrible sports words, let's see what they do with their lives. Let's see how it goes. Let's see if they win Super Bowls before we start anointing.
I think that's why William's point of it being marketing is well taken. They have to say they're elite in order to give people a reason to watch, because otherwise it's just going to be like, oh, let's watch these people try to prove themselves, which to most people is not interesting. To us, that's interesting, right? I think it's phenomenally interesting that we're on the precipice here where, you know, once Brady and Rodgers go away, and I'm counting Big Ben as gone already because he's Big Ben and he's been checked out for years. But once they go away, there's going to be this vacuum of Super Bowl winning quarterbacks. I mean, unless we count Joe Flacco, but he died this year, right?
Who?
Okay. My point being, there's going to be this vacuum of who's going to step up and who's going to be the person who wins consistently and wins multiple titles. I mean, I guess Russell Wilson's won a title, right? Oh, he was the other one they named, right? And that's something I want to touch on in a minute about this article. So I do think there's a little bit of marketing here where it's like, you know, watch this because these people are elite. Where rather, I think what's interesting is who's going to step up and who's going to fill the vacuum that's left. What was the other thing I was going to say before I went into the controversial points about this article? I don't remember what the other thing I was going to say besides it. Oh, I know what I was going to say. This puts me in an unenviable position with Lamar Jackson because I'm going to keep sounding like this, but I already saw this in college where he won the Heisman the next year and then was shit the next year. But I think Lamar Jackson's a flash in the pan, and I know I keep saying that, and it's just going to seem like I am a hater for Lamar Jackson, but I just don't think he's going to be able to be more than one-dimensional as he develops, and I think he's going to end up like RG3 or Michael Vick. I really do. I don't think he's going to have longevity, as you're saying, Daniel. And then also, when you're talking about longevity, it points to the importance of a good coach who can help you learn and grow. And this is why when people argue who's Brady better, Brady or Belichick, who's more important to the Patriots' success, you can't separate the two. Because, yeah, Brady's phenomenal, and he helped Belichick win. But Belichick helped Brady win in the long term by helping him continue to learn and grow about the game, to grow and learn about the game. And without Belichick, Brady wouldn't have been able to do that. Because if you stay as you are, you're not going to win as consistently. They don't win those three later titles if Brady and Belichick didn't continue to grow together. And that's what you need. And we're seeing this with Patrick Mahomes, where Andy Reid has a history of game planning excellently. Andy Reid can figure out how to maximize his own strengths and minimize his own weaknesses. But you know what Andy Reid can't do, Daniel?
What, win?
Well, right. Why can't he win? What can't he do with his game planning?
Manage the clock.
I was going to say he can't adapt. He can't make in-game adjustments. He can't make in-season adjustments. Andy Reid is very good at that initial game plan, but after that, he can't adapt. And that's why, even though Mahomes is playing phenomenally, the Chiefs are an average team, because he can't adapt. And that lack of adaptation is killing his team's abilities. Everyone knows what they're going to do now, and they just game plan for that thing. And he can't change anything up. And it shows. Mahomes is a perfect example how good coaching can help or hinder someone. So there's a lot with this article. But there's one last thing I want to point out in this article, and I want to ask a question because maybe I don't remember correctly. Was Jimmy Garoppolo listed in the possible elite quarterbacks in the new generation?
No.
So was there something all of them had in common that were listed?
They're all young.
That's what it is?
You're not going to make me say
they all are male?
No, I'm throwing back to Rush Limbaugh here. Remember when Rush Limbaugh was trying to be on NFL, the morning show, and they gave him the segment where he threw the yellow flag and said things, and then they fired him for being Rush Limbaugh?
Yes.
Right.
I remember that.
What I mean by they fired him for being Rush Limbaugh, they're like, hey, Rush Limbaugh, come on and talk about football. And then he talked about football, and he talked about Donovan McNabb, which, by the way, history proved him correct.
To be clear, he talked about the media.
Right.
He talked about the media. That is the Rush Limbaugh thing. He was saying, hey, the media is coddling this quarterback.
Right. He said that when they were talking about Donovan McNabb and how good he is, he said, McNabb's not that good. I think the media is very desirous to see a black quarterback do well. Well, Rush Limbaugh, I think how many years later you've been proven correct with this article?
Yeah, the article, the article sort of points out about itself, and then it says, like, but pay no attention to that part. It's really their play. And again, if you look at anything in a short enough scope, you can probably be right about what you're saying when you're making grand statements about eliteness and greatness in a very short period of time. I will withhold judgment on anyone, including Jimmy Garoppolo or anyone else, until they've done something. Okay, winning games is fine, but that ultimately you have to win championships. Ultimately, you have to have sustained greatness. And until that point, no one gets elite. No one gets Hall of Fame. No one gets anything until you've actually done it.
Well, and to be fair, it's not even winning games at this point, right? I mean, if we're going to be critical, let's be critical, okay? You know I love Deshaun Watson. You know he has a special place in my heart. Clemson, all of that. But all they're talking about with Deshaun Watson is his physical feats. His stats is what they're saying he's elite about. Has Deshaun Watson even proven to be a consistent winner in the NFL?
Not yet, but he's still very young.
Well, no, 100%, and I'm not saying he's not a winner either. I think your reserving judgment is correct. But my point is, I'm just trying to show my fairness here. My point is, when I look at Deshaun Watson and I say, that's a quarterback I can trust in crunch time, I believe that in my heart because I want to believe that because I saw what he did to Alabama with Hunter Renfrow in the national title game. But I've seen more out of Hunter Renfrow in clutch situations in Oakland in his 11 games so far, 12 games, however many games Oakland's played, than I have from Deshaun Watson. Hunter Renfrow is still out there making third down catches, still out there making touchdown catches in crunch time situations. So now I have to wonder, was it Deshaun Watson on that touchdown, or was it Hunter Renfrow getting open and making it easy for Deshaun Watson?
It's all of the above. And the one thing I'll say in defense of Deshaun Watson and watching him play is that the team around him is so not up to his level. And I don't just mean the offensive line, which is essentially non-existent. The offensive line is offensively bad.
I don't understand the Texans. They're like, every year it's like, you know what's really bad? Our offensive line. Let's draft more defense.
That's right. We're a defensive team. But remember, was it against the Saints where with no time left, he like moved down the field in like 13 seconds to score a touchdown in some of the most remarkable plays I've ever seen in the NFL, but no one will ever talk about it again because they left too much time on the clock, bad coaching, and thus let Drew Brees come back for a field goal.
Well, and that was the other thing I was going to say is it's tough with Deshaun Watson as well because he's stuck with a middling coach. Bill O'Brien is an above average coach. He's not terrible, but he's not great either. It's sort of like the Chiefs are stuck with Andy Reid for a while too. It's just sort of, it's bad for Deshaun Watson. And again, I'm not trying to talk bad about Deshaun Watson. I'm just trying to be equal here.
The ultimate example of this, I think, which should give everyone pause about the anointing of people, and it has nothing to do with race, it was Andrew Luck. Andrew Luck was essentially kissed into the Hall of Fame the moment he was drafted. And he played well, but he was never, to use the term, an elite quarterback, at least when it mattered.
I don't even think he's played as well as Russell Wilson or Deshaun Watson or Patrick Mahomes. I don't even think Andrew Luck stacks up to any of those three.
Certainly not Russell Wilson, who is, if anything, underrated. Sorry.
But, I hate the Seahawks, but okay.
I know you do, but he is.
I just fucking hate Pete Carroll. The problem is I like Russell Wilson, but I hate Pete Carroll. So it's like I begrudgingly have to like Russell Wilson. You get what I'm saying? That's how much I hate Pete Carroll.
Anyway. Right, William, any closing thoughts?
Yeah.
I know we hogged the time.
You did hog the time. I just wanted to mention two big things from the college world. The first one, the most important story being, did you guys watch the Harvard versus Yale fiasco? So they protested climate change instead of playing their terrible yearly rivalry game. But yeah, they held up the game for a bit. The students who protested begged to be arrested, so they were taken off two by two, kind of like Noah's Ark style, off the field. They really just wanted to be arrested for the cause. Talk about virtue signaling. Justin, you had a question about their carbon emissions.
Yeah, I showed this. I talked to a friend about it, and he said, how much more carbon was emitted into the atmosphere because of the delay in the game?
It's true. Well, if you don't want climate protesters interrupting your game, maybe you shouldn't go to Harvard or Yale. I think that's their fault. Personally.
And you said you had another thing, too?
The other thing to talk about is... In the continuing saga of Ohio State being an unstoppable monster, the best team Ohio State has had in years, the best team in college football, I don't think there's any way, despite us playing them at home next week, that we can win. But is there any way to stop this hype train about how good Ohio State is?
When we look at it compared to the other teams in the playoffs again.
Yeah. Yeah. They're good. Like I said, I don't expect to win next weekend. But why? Why is this? This is another sort of like anointing them before they've earned anything. It's crazy how much praise they get in the media for what has been at times inconsistent play.
All right, yeah. you brought me here, and I wasn't going to talk about this, but I'm going to talk about this.
Buckle up.
Since you fucking brought it up. Yeah, that's right. Fucking buckle up. All right, you want to know how you beat them? This is how you beat them. When you're down by 11 with 3.5 minutes left in the fourth quarter and you're on your own 42 and it's 4th-and-2, you don't false start twice. You especially don't false start the first time coming out of a timeout. Fuck you, center from Penn State. That was like the biggest fucking blue balls in the entire goddamn world. I was watching the fourth quarter of the Penn State-Ohio State game, and that's how you fucking lose the game? That's how you lose the game. Your entire season is on the line. You are the number 8 or 9 team. You're playing the number 2 team. You're down by 11. There's 3.5 minutes left. It's 4th-and-2. You need that one play to keep your chance of winning the title of your conference title, your division title, your conference title, and getting into the playoffs. You need that 4th-and-2. Your coach calls a timeout, and out of the timeout, you false start. So then it's 4th-and-7, and you false start again? The same player? Are you kidding me? I watch that, and I go,
How many tattoos did he earn for that?
I don't know. He probably got it. I don't know. It's so angry. It's so incompetent. If you run a play and it fails, fine, you ran the play. But if you're going to lose, don't lose on stupid mistakes like that. Coming out of a timeout. Fuck.
So that's it. That's your college view for this week.
I can't
unbuckle.
Wait. I can't wait until Clemson plays Ohio State again in the playoffs. Remember when we went through this like 3 years ago and everyone said they were going to kill us and we beat the shit out of them? Does everyone remember that?
Yeah,
I do remember that.
Doesn't
this
feel the same?
Do you know how many years I've won a bunch of money in our office football pool because no one except me believes in Clemson?
It feels the same. Doesn't it feel the same again?
Yeah.
They did it with Notre Dame last year. They did it with Ohio State that year. It feels the same again.
Yeah. Every year, I win a bunch of money. It's awesome.
All right. That about does that this week. Thanks for checking in with us. For now, we're on to the Cowboys or the Texans. I don't know how it works because of the recording schedule. Just hit the music.
My face, your face, instant face. Go talk to whoever you want that does that stuff.
All right, let's wrap this episode up, gentlemen. What did we learn this trip, William?
Well, I learned that 143,000 cucks exist in North America.
I had a similar learning this week. Usually I try to do something different, but I learned that much like Steve Jobs introducing the iPad, Elon Musk has found a new audience and giving them a product they never knew they needed. Justin?
I learned that Epstein didn't kill himself, that it was the perfect storm of screw-ups. So I learned that anytime I want to deflect from what really happened, I can just say it was the perfect storm of screw-ups and everyone will magically believe me.
Well, we hope you learned something this week. We'll keep it hyper short this week. TheMidSide.com is where you go for all of your Midside stuff, including podcasts, merch. You can go to Patreon there. You can do whatever you want there. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, 5 stars. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us. Go to Patreon.com/TheMidSide to help us keep the lights on. And until next time, we love you, especially when you tell a friend about the show.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin M. Lesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a I got a ride in my wife's boyfriend's cuck truck day.
You think this is going to be like the back-in parking thing where like 98% of our audience actually thinks it's the coolest looking truck in the history of time and we're the ones who are wrong about this?
I think about the back-in parking.
There's a coin flip that this is the next DeLorean.
It's true. It's true.
I watched though I just have to be clear about this. I watched a guy in a minivan with his family in the minivan, start backing into a parking spot, then realize he had to get something from the trunk. So he stopped halfway, got something out of the trunk, and then continued backing in. I am not wrong about the back-in parking.
The cuck truck likes it when you back in.